So Kyoto collapsed, Copenhagen kicked the can. Get it? Copenhagen, can. And when are we going to do something about carbon emissions and what? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. So what do you think we ought to do and what can be done? Today's guests have some idea. Our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And the idea bears a remarkable resemblance to the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, as we'll hear on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, on the one hand, it seems that there are so many forces impeding any sort of path to sustainability. But on the other hand, maybe there is still a path. But can we see it? It's kind of the thing that we've been sort of exploring here on this program off and on for the last 3 or 4 years as the price of energy went up so high and Alaskans got really serious about what are we going to do about how much our fuel is costing us. It's killing us. And we don't really have any solutions, but we've made some progress nonetheless. And we've certainly had some interesting discussions along these lines about where we might could go. And I'm going to continue that today. You may recall back in January, we had a fellow on the air named Todd Moss from the Center for Global Development. And lo and behold, he was suggesting the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend as a concept for countries which are about to become oil rich, like a number of countries in Africa. And he was saying there's good reasons for doing this. And Todd's going to be back with us here in the later part of the program. But first, I want to introduce you to somebody else who's picking up this idea, and that's Peter Barnes, and he hasn't even got his book written yet. So we're catching him before the book comes out. And so then I have to apologize for also not having read yet his very influential book, Who Owns the Sky? Peter Barnes, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Great to be here, Steve.
So you live down there in Marin. And following Who Owns the Sky, you went on to write Capitalism 3.0. And this has to do with the tendency is to say there's one end of the spectrum is capitalism and the other is socialism. And the twain should never meet. You know, if you're a capitalist, you can't be a socialist, and if you're a socialist, you can't be a capitalist. And what you're suggesting is essentially just looking at those things which, well, I guess I'll have to call them the commons, just as Wally Hickel called them the commons. So tell me, how in the world do you get to a system where you're actually generating gain from the commons? How do you get there?
Well, how do you get there? Okay, well, the short answer is you need a lot more people like Jay Hammond. But the longer answer is, first of all, you have to see and recognize the commons. It tends to be largely invisible. But it's huge when you actually stop to think about it. You could start with water. You could start with air. You could start with the Internet. All of our knowledge, science, culture, art, sidewalks, infrastructure of all sorts, financial as well as physical, and on and on. There have been some studies done that say that the commonwealth, which I would loosely define, let me just say that when you use the word, or when anyone uses the word commons, it immediately brings up the image of a pasture with sheep grazing on it, and it's thought of as something historical that has no relevance today. But the definition or concept of commons that I'm talking about is bigger. It's not just pastures. It's everything that we share, and there's a lot of that stuff. The problem is, actually, as Walter Hickel himself once said, you can steal, I think this is a quote, I'm paraphrasing, and he said, you can steal $10 from a man out of his pocket, and he'll get really mad. But if you steal billions from the commons, which belong to all of us and our children, nobody even notices. And that's kind of what's been going on for a couple of centuries in our country, is continuous taking from the commons and also dumping into the commons, which is sort of the flip side of that. When we pollute commons, we're destroying their value and not paying anything while we do that. Anyway, if you put all that together and think of it as, even though there's a lot of different and very very different parts of the commons, we need to think of it as wealth that belongs to all of us, and we all have a right to that wealth, first of all, and we also have a responsibility to protect it and pass it on undiminished to future generations.
All right, now I'm thinking, there's, let's say, I have nice clean air, I have clean water, I'd just soon it stay that way, and that's our common property. But the problem then is something happens because of somebody, let's say, pollutes the air of my little rancho in Spinard by having a motorcycle shop next door. And so my recourse in our system would seem to have been that I can either invoke some kind of zoning law or something, or I can take a civil court action to get compensated for the taking of this clean air that I had. And you're
right.
You're saying that actually there's another way. You don't have to go to court. You could do it some other way.
Right. You shouldn't have to go to court. What you're talking about is like a micro example, and if we leap from the micro to the macro and think about climate change, where we have, of course, millions, hundreds of millions, billions of people and lots of corporations dumping carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the common atmosphere that we all share. Now, it shouldn't be up to each of us to sue, you know, for every dumping of that sort of waste. We need a kind of a economy-wide system to deal with that. And what I proposed in that first book that you mentioned, Who Owns the Sky, you know, that was sort of a question to get people thinking. And the answer that I proposed is, yes, we all own it together, collectively, because nobody made it. It's just a gift that we all received. But we ought to think of it as property, in a sense, common property, community property. But we need somebody to run it, just the way private property is usually managed by some entity. So imagine, then, that we had a trust that was acting on behalf of all of us to own at least our nation, America's share of the global atmosphere. And that trust would say to people who want to dump crap into their property, our property, well, wait, no. First of all, you have to get permission, and you can do that, maybe, by buying a permit from us. Of course, we're going to gradually decrease the number of permits that we sell, because we want to keep this asset you know, our climate in good shape for future generations. As we decrease the number of permits that we're willing to sell, the price of each permit is going to go up, supply and demand, and the revenue will go up. And in fact, a huge amount of money will flow into this trust. And then looking at the Alaska Permanent Fund as a model, but just even without that, just saying, well, who does this money belong to? It belongs to all of us equally, one person, one share, and we ought to return it in the form of dividends. So the result of that is a very simple system that would deal with climate change, at least on a national level, and at the same time, it would provide some income like the Alaska Permanent Fund to everybody, which I think has enormous economic benefits to our country, given the fact that, you know, so many people are either have no jobs or have very low-paying jobs and need some form of extra income. So we'd accomplish an awful lot by sort of organizing this commons, the atmosphere, in a way that benefits all of us who are living today as well as future generations.
And that became what was known as cap and dividend, and it didn't even get as far as cap and trade, as far as I can tell, in the U.S. Congress, but at least Maria Cantwell tried to introduce it. And the first I had heard of it was a couple of years ago at the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, when they had a session with Jim Hansen, the NASA guy, who's advocating for basically a 350 ceiling on our, we got to get back to 350 ppm of carbon dioxide. We simply have to, and we got to find ways to do it. And he's real big on this cap and dividend idea. And this workshop has brought me a number of really thought-provoking guests for Talk of Alaska. And in a way, indirectly, you're the latest because you're the cap and dividend guy. You're where the idea started. But he was excited about this because he said that's the answer to the damage that people say that capping our carbon emissions would do to the economy.
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, one of the effects of capping carbon emissions is it's going to raise energy prices. But if you take the revenue from selling the permits and give it back to everybody equally, you offset the higher energy prices. In fact, well, you offset them in aggregate terms, but on an individual basis, it's up to you. If you conserve energy, if you don't buy so much gasoline or use carbon-based fuels indirectly, the money you get back in dividends will exceed the extra money you're paying for because of the carbon cap. So you'll come out ahead. So this creates an incentive, a reward system for people who do the right thing. So there's a micro-level reward, which is very good. There's also a macro-level reward because as you lower the cap, the price goes up and the dividends go up. So it actually collectively makes economic sense to keep reducing pollution. So it's win-win all around, except, of course, the energy companies don't really like it.
We're talking with Peter Barnes, author of Who Owns the Sky? Capitalism 3.0, co-founder of Working Assets Long Distance, and we're going into this business about the commons and the cap and dividend concept. Now, I think there's some economic theorists that are sitting here and saying, now, wait a second, this guy is trying to get something out of nothing. This guy is trying to, you know, if you drive down economic growth, you are going to penalize everybody, period. What do you say to that?
Well, Yeah. This is not going to drive down economic growth, or if it does, it would be a minute percentage. But basically what it will do by raising the price of carbon-based fuels, it will make non-carbon-based energy sources competitive. I used to be in the solar energy business many years ago, back in the 1970s.
It wasn't Solyndra. Was it Solyndra? Please don't tell me it was
Solyndra. No, it was way before that.
Thank you.
It was when Jimmy Carter was president, and there was a 25% tax credit for solar energy, which Ronald Reagan subsequently repealed. But for a brief moment back then, there was a nascent solar industry, and I was part of it. Anyway, my point is that we needed some kind of subsidy then, and even to some extent now, to even the playing field between clean energy and dirty fossil fuel energy. That's because the price of fossil fuels are so low. But if you raise that price, then you can have a level playing field between all sorts of clean energy and the dirty kind. So, yes, energy per se will cost more, but this won't necessarily slow economic growth because we'll adapt to that. That's what always happens. We come up with ways to use less energy, and it will just spur a different kind of growth. It won't send us back to the Stone Age or anything like that.
Well, I'm thinking back to the telecom bubble when everybody thought you could have a kind of an economic growth that was totally information-based and didn't have anything to do with any kind of hard good. Well, it didn't quite work that way, but then again, it was a bubble. It didn't mean that economy didn't exist. It obviously exists.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's still something real there, and it's a something economic entity of some sort. 1-800-478-8255 to join our conversation with Peter Barnes here. We're talking money. We're talking investment. We're talking dividends. We're talking what do you actually do about carbon emissions if you're going to do anything. And we're also talking about, I think we're talking a little bit about distribution of wealth. But maybe I'm wrong. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's a local number at 550-8422. Toll-free across the state, 1-800-478-8255. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're going to continue to stir the pot on this conversation. So tell me, how do you respond to my suggesting that this is about redistribution of wealth, Peter Barnes?
Well, I wouldn't call it redistribution. I would call it pre-distribution. In other words, I think we all own the commons. If anybody owns them, it's everybody. But we're not getting any value out of it. So what I'm talking about, or what I talk about in these various books that I've written, are ways to capture and, in fact, monetize not all, but some of the wealth of the commons and share it amongst everybody. So we're not taking away anything from anybody. We're not abolishing corporations or raising taxes. We are doing one thing, though, which is important. We're making especially corporations that take from the commons or use it in some way or another without paying, we are making them pay. That's where the money comes from that then gets distributed. And that's okay, because these are true costs that corporations, when they don't pay those true costs, they externalize them. They make nature pay, or future generations pay, or all of us as taxpayers.
Okay, yeah, and the return, and then the return just goes to the investors or the shareholders or whatever. But it's at an expense. Okay, that's I wanted to get at that, and I'm sure that this has come up real quickly, and that is people that say, look, this is just too materialistic, putting a price on everything now. And that's what Karl Marx predicted would happen, and it was bad when we started when money started working its way into the households, and we put the women into the workforce and so forth, this is just going to make it worse. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard that.
Well, yeah, I have heard that, and there's truth to it. I mean, it does put more prices on more things that currently aren't priced. But unfortunately, we actually, given the kind of system we have, if we don't put prices on things like the air, or dumping pollution into the air, we're going to have lots of pollution. So it's necessary to put some prices on things that currently aren't priced. But the key is, if we're going to do that, and I'm saying that we have to do it really, but we have to make sure that the revenue that comes from these new prices doesn't just flow to the same corporations that get most of that stuff now. If we make sure that it flows to everybody, then it's okay to put those prices on things that are currently unpriced.
I don't think that you can find the price that's high enough for not having a tornado. Let's go to Frank joining the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Frank.
Hi, yesterday I was on top of Pillar Mountain here in Kodiak. Got to see the wind turbines. The lady gave us the tour, said that there are certain days now when Kodiak gets 80% of its electricity from the turbines. Between that and hydro, Kodiak is able to generate its energy in a clean way. I would like to offer this as an alternative for folks looking to create jobs in Bristol Bay. There's a lot of wind out there. One of the questions that the lady answered was, do the birds get hurt by these turbines? And she said that that wasn't happening. We didn't see any evidence of that. I think that pebble mine is dangerous, and perhaps producing electricity with wind turbines would be something that our state politicians could vocalize. I've been disappointed that I haven't heard someone with the opportunity to get up and speak against pebble mine on a national level. I haven't heard it happen. There are Alaskans working in government that have access to the national media pretty much whenever they want it. Here's a chance to step up and protect our fish and our water and to look out for the children. I would also like to remind people that, there's a gap right now between tribes on the mainland and Alaskan Natives as far as what's going on with sovereignty, and that the sovereignty of all indigenous people in North America continues to be under assault. For example, in New York, tribes have sold cigarettes and have been able to do that tax-free. Well, now New York State is in financial trouble, and they're demanding that that money is that the cigarettes or tobacco is now taxed, and that the state gets that money. So sovereignty and how sovereign you are as an indigenous person in North America is subjective based on where you live, and be careful. I would remind people that that land grabs and attacks on indigenous people are not just in the history books. They continue to happen, maybe very politely, at a time when we can say, oh, we're a very open-minded society. But I would say that Pebble Mine is in that category. Thanks, and thank you for discussing this today. And let's support green energy in Alaska. Thank you.
All right, Frank. Yeah, you guys are in a really nice position with regards to renewable energy there on the rocks. Thanks for your call, Frank, from Kodiak. Let's go to Harry, joins the program from Anchorage. Harry, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. And what a beautiful morning, huh?
Ah, I think I hear a Cajun tone to that voice.
Well, almost. Certainly Louisiana.
How you doing, Mr. Louisiana?
Excellent. And I just wanted to say that I went to the National Renewable Energy Laboratories in outside Denver last week on my own dime to find out how to integrate more renewable energy into our grid. And the subject that you have this morning is near and dear to my heart for so many reasons. If working people are going to compete with the Koch brothers and all, we have to organize. We have to put our capital together, or else we're just going to be drowned out in the public media by the Koch brothers and others that are going to use the commons for their own, like you're saying. So it is all interrelated. I just love this subject that you've brought up this morning, because there's nothing more pressing to our future.
Yeah, Harry. Well, Peter Barnes. Harry is a board member of one of our utilities here that's invested in invested as it probably as not as much as it would like, but is invested in a wind farm now, and so that's the perspective he's speaking from. He's also been in the state legislature.
I also had a bill when that I introduced in the legislature to do a savings account for each and every person in Alaska, where we would put possibly 3 to 4% of our income in, and then pay it out on a percent of market value prorated to each person's investment. To allow that fund to grow, and you know that you could voluntarily put your permanent fund dividend or
just
or
turn it just basically it. turn it over into the POMV formula.
Right.
Yeah. Hey Harry, thank you very much. I want to ask some questions here, Peter, but I really appreciate your call.
Well, we're going to continue on. My goal is to get more renewable energy integrated into our grid and stop investing in more fossil fuel.
Yeah, I wonder if you're one of the few remaining co-ops. Of course, we have electric co-ops in Alaska still, but I mean across the country, most of them eaten up and privatized and. So you actually have the point of view of maybe the trustees that Peter Barnes is talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask him about that now. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Harry.
One other question, or not question, statement. You said that there are two terms, capitalism or socialism, and that never the twain shall meet. I believe that what's in the middle is ownerism, where everybody owns a piece of the pie.
Ownerism. Thanks, Harry. How do you like that? Ownerism, Peter Barnes.
I think that's fantastic, and I think Harry should run for the Senate from Alaska. I really like him.
Well, he's tried to run for the House. It didn't work out so well.
Well, try again, Harry. You're a great guy.
And this business of
was a great word.
Yeah. Who would run the who would be these trustees be? I mean, people don't exactly trust the government to do it. So how do you do something that's not the government?
Well, you need. I mean, in the ideal, I would say you would have independent trustees, kind of like the members of the board of a co-op, but not necessarily. I mean, you could. Have the idea of a trustee or a trust. This is an old, centuries-old legal concept where the trustee is by law required to be accountable solely to whoever the beneficiary of the trust is. Like if you want to leave some money for a grandchild to go to college or something, you appoint somebody to be the trustee, and they just have to act on behalf of the grandchild. So if you used that legal construct of the trust, it wouldn't matter that much how the trustees were appointed. They could be elected, they could be appointed by the governor, say as the I believe the Alaska Permanent Fund Board is appointed by the governor. Federal Reserve Board members are appointed by the president, for example. But once they're in office, they have legally enforceable duties to act solely on behalf of beneficiaries. If they violate that trust, they can be sued. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. Now,
Yeah. This is fascinating. We're speaking with Peter Barnes, author of Who Owns the Sky? Capitalism 3.0 and a forthcoming book on the commons. And he's become fascinated with the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, and the basic idea is that there are commons, there are assets that we have in common that are taken through indirect costs of economic development, corporate expansion, and so forth, and perhaps that should be paid for, and the proceeds of that then should be invested. And this could be applied to, say, a carbon tax and dividend, where, of course, the price of fuel is going to go up and it's going to escalate in terms of going up. But at the same time, that goes back to a dividend that goes to those people that have to pay that cost. It's a way of, I guess, what Jay Hammond would call clawing back something for the people, clawing back. And it's interesting to watch these ideas from Alaska spreading elsewhere, because there was no lack of people that called the whole thing crazy at the time. And for years, there was a mentality that didn't always get spoken publicly, because pretty soon the dividend that was paid became sacred. You didn't dare attack that, but they would attack sideways and say, well, sooner or later, the IRS is going to come after you. And they would say, you know, this money is now just being invested for maximum yield. It really should be going to infrastructure that would pay off in jobs, you know. And none of those things can get all that much traction. Because of that dividend. It's the dividend that does it. It's the part that goes to people that they will, of course, defend with a good deal of energy, a political constituency.
Go ahead, Peter.
I was going to say, I think it's obviously investing in infrastructure is an important thing to do, and it's a proper function for the state. But I think it's important to distinguish between the state and the commons. The two are not the same thing. The state should tax various things and use tax revenues to do things like invest in education and infrastructure, that sort of thing. That's fine. But at the same time, the commons is like property that belongs to the people, here's another key point. People need income that is non-labor. People have to work. That's good. I'm all for people working. But the fact is that, labor income by itself is not getting most people very far. Everybody should have some non-labor income. This is one of the things that Alaska has led the way in. So income, but where's that non-labor income going to come from? It shouldn't necessarily come from taxes. It can come from stuff that we already own legitimately, although not in actual reality. And then if the government wants to tax dividends from the commons the way it taxes dividends from corporations, that's fine. You know, it's income. It can be taxed in a progressive way. But keep the state separate from the commons. That's kind of what I'm saying.
Wow. Okay. Very thought-provoking. Peter Barnes, our guest, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
We're speaking with Peter Barnes about how the Alaska Permanent Fund plays into the concept of the commons that he's working with, which is related to the cap and dividend idea that Maria Cantwell put forth in the Senate. But they went with the cap and trade instead. And joining us now, and stay on the line there, Peter, joining us now from Washington, D.C., his office at the Center for Global Development, is our former guest, Todd Moss, who wrote the book or put together, edited the book, The Governor's Solution, How Alaska's Oil Dividend Could Work in Iraq and Other Oil-Rich Countries. Todd, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Nice to talk to you again.
Well, you were just up here. How did that go?
Yes, I just had I just got back from a trip up to Anchorage, Homer, and Lake Clark. Fantastic, as you might imagine. But what I was up there doing was trying to understand how Governor Jay Hammond and his team and his allies in the legislature were able to get the idea of the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend accepted. How did they get over that hump, and what might we learn from their experience for other countries?
So I assume you talked to Clem Tillion at some point.
I did. I had the great honor of spending a whole day with Clem and hearing all about how it happened.
Yeah, and all about a bunch of other things, probably.
So you know Clem.
Oh, you betcha. It was very odd to get Clem, and I were at some leadership conference, and everybody's gloomy about the future except me and Clem. We just looked at one another.
Well, I had, of course, it was wonderful to spend the time with him and learn from all of his tremendous experience, hear the stories about the early days of Alaska, and also about the political fights that they had in the 70s and 80s. And what really struck me, other than his relentless energy, even at 88 years old, he's full of energy, is that a lot of the issues that Alaska was struggling with, things like corruption in infrastructure projects, wasted resources, environmental management issues, all kinds of issues like that are almost exactly the kinds of issues that lots of countries, particularly in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, are struggling with right now, when many of them are suddenly finding themselves with an oil or natural gas boom.
Yeah, and your idea, just briefly put, and I hate to do violence to something you've got a whole book about, but still, is that these countries should look at something like the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, because that puts wealth in the hands of the people, and then you can tax the people, which is the very thing that Peter Barnes was just talking about with his idea of the commons, with actually almost the same idea. And as you probably know from Who Owns the Sky, that idea was, was part of the cap and dividend, that you could have a carbon tax, and if it paid money to people, it might be a more doable thing politically. So you guys are, I think, meeting each other for the first time. Is that right, Peter?
That's right. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Peter. Nice to speak to you.
Right. I read your book, and I really liked it. And I think what's interesting is that what you're talking about is applying the Alaska model to countries, developing countries mostly, that have a kind of a resource bonanza, which is great. And what I'm talking about is applying it to the rest of the United States. So it's interesting to see how broadly this model actually can be applied.
I think that's right. I think the principles are very similar. The idea is that you want to try to embed a sense of ownership in the population so that they have incentives to behave well, and to also put pressure on their government to behave in a responsible manner. So it's nice that Alaskans get a dividend, and I'm sure people in Tanzania or Bolivia or in East Timor would also like to get a dividend from their country's wealth. That's a nice benefit. But really, the big benefit is that it creates very, very powerful constituencies in the country to watch what the government is doing when they're signing contracts and receiving money from foreign companies. And that was something that really struck me in my visit to Alaska. It didn't surprise me, but it certainly struck me that the level of public discussion about things like mining and oil and gas policy, natural resource policy, is extremely high, and certainly something Alaskans should be proud of.
Yeah, you know, Todd, one thing you said that really struck me during that program was you can't really tax people that ain't got anything.
Yeah,
that's a simple thing, but you know, it's totally true. And
yeah,
people that ain't got anything are not necessarily going to feel very invested in the system that's not giving them anything.
Exactly. And it's not just the people aren't vested, it's that the government, if they're not getting taxes from the population, they're not reliant on collecting those taxes, then they don't care what they think either. So if it's easier to cut a deal with a foreign oil company than it is to build a relationship with your own population through a tax system, then of course you're going to take the easier route.
So I want to continue trying to meld your ideas. And Todd, one idea that Peter Barnes has is that you need trustees for the revenue that you can generate by selling off or taxing for charging a fee to get at the commons. And so this is like, if you pollute, you pay a fee, and then you have the right to pollute, but then what happens to that money? And he's saying, well, that would go to some trustees. And I'm wondering what you would make of that, because I'm sure there are people listening right now say, well, it's just another level of government. But
right,
his answer to that is basically, well, they have a mission, and you could sue them if they don't suit their mission,
which is...
you know, to whatever it is that you bind the trustees to do.
Yeah. Well, okay, so this, I haven't thought about this very long. You just threw this at me. So,
but you're in a think tank, so you can think.
Yeah,
now.
That's right. So, look, I do think that there are two critical roles here if something like that's going to work. You need a structure, a governance structure of some kind that sets the rules. Okay, what are the fees going to be? How will they be applied? How will they be collected? Somebody has to do that. And then you need maybe it's the same structure or maybe it's a different structure. You need somebody to decide almost, I think trustees is a good word, how those will be allocated. Now, what's interesting in the case of Alaska is that for the permanent fund, you have a professional fund management team down in Juneau that manages the resources of the fund, and you had the legislature decide what were the rules for distributing to citizens. So you've got a government agency doing that, and you've got a quasi-government-owned independent firm that's doing the management. So that I think, trying to replicate some kind of governance structure like that, I think makes a lot of sense.
All right. I'm going to go back to you, Peter. And, so let's say that these licenses or whatever are sold with their escalating price, and then you have trustees that decide about investment. So where do they invest? I mean, doesn't that just go right back into the same old system that's despoiling the environment in the first place? You know, I have this problem with my own investment. You know, I don't like to give money to, buy stock in corporations I don't think are sustainable. But the way that they look at it, they're just returning shareholder value, and they don't have any incentive to think very far into the future. In fact, they just dissolve, and if they do generate a whole lot of value, they can get taken over by somebody. And it's, to me, none of that is sustainable. I'd rather just loan money and, have bonds. So that's why I try and keep my money in bonds. But that's not a real good solution either.
No. First of all, I think you have to distinguish between investing the revenue and just giving it back. Now, Alaska invests, Norway invests, but in the cap and dividend model that was proposed by Senator Cantwell that you mentioned, the revenue is not invested. It is just, the part that goes to the government, I think in her bill she had, it was kind of the reverse of Alaska. You have 75-25. What she was proposing was 25-75. 75% would go back directly to the people, would not be invested or spent by government. 25% would go to the government to be used as Congress would decide in the future.
Okay. Did her staff come to you when they were formulating that and say, hey, how do you think this would work? I mean...
Yeah. No, they did. I was at one point an advocate of giving 100% back to the people because of the problem, first of all, of the higher prices that will result, and you need to recycle that revenue in order to offset the higher prices. But the 25-75 formula is okay, too. As a matter of just crude political reality, you need about 25% of the revenue to buy off enough senators to pass a bill like that. In other words, you kind of go around and say, well, we're going to use some of it for this, farmers or something or other, and you kind of put together your political coalition that way. Or you say, as there's now some energy towards saying, okay, we'll use 25% in a new version, 25% to reduce the federal deficit. That kind of pleases conservatives. And then 75%. Okay. Dividends back to the people. That's a good formula. Anyway, it's tricky when you get into the nitty-gritty of politics how you design these things.
Well, I'm sure Todd agrees with you there.
Yeah.
it's Talk of Alaska. We'll take Aunt Mary. I want to thank you very much for listening and calling, and we have some callers ahead of you. We'll get to you, but I really appreciate your call. And Mark will be with you in just a second, so I know you're probably limited phone service there on Horse Island as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Hard to say if we're getting anywhere with this conversation, but it certainly is thought-provoking. And that's what we aim for on Talk of Alaska. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, toll free across the state. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. And don't forget that email at talk@alaskapublic.org. And Mark joins the program right now from Horse Island. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Mark.
Greetings, Steve. Thanks, as always, for taking my call. And I enjoy Peter's work. So thanks for having him on and asking, as always, the
Yes, Mark, go ahead.
We're talking about the Commons, especially because Volnickel is an old friend.
Uh-oh. Yeah, we're losing your signal. It's too bad.
You hear me now?
I hear you now.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'll come on. You know, we do seem to be living in a time where only money seems to motivate people, and the world has decided in general that hydrocarbons are the way for the near future. Now, you know, the Commons don't.
We lost you again, Mark. I'm sorry, Mark, but it's it just pixelated itself out of existence in this digital world of ours. Sometimes this happens, and he's on Horse Island. I mean, Lord knows what the hell kind of connection that was. But I would say that he's talking about carbon post-carbon, let's just say. So, Peter, some thoughts on that, post-carbon.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of post-carbon energy sources, as the one of your earlier callers was talking about, wind. I suspect wind and hydro are pretty plentiful up in Alaska. Sun, maybe not so much, at least in the winter. So it's just a question, really, of economics. We have the technology. Countries like Germany are going whole hog to replace not only hydrocarbons but nuclear power with all sorts of renewables. So
This is doable. It can't be done overnight, but it can be done in 20, 30 years if we send the right signals to the economy. And putting a cap and a price on carbon is really the most important signal that we could send to the economy. And I think if we did that and ramped it up over 20, 30 years, we would get there.
Well, I think the political equation, the investment equation would be that would change the, because the oil industry currently has to look 30 years ahead. They would start investing accordingly. And some of them have, you know, made these sort of spurts over towards renewables and diversification and so forth. But I'm wondering, I mean, essentially what's going on right now, like, just take a company like Exxon, and Todd, you probably know this. Exxon is able to book all those tar sands as reserves. And this is a form of energy where you have to put almost as much energy in in order to get the energy out. But there's a lot of it, see? So that makes it a reserve, so they can book it that way and keep themselves sustainable in terms of shareholder value. A carbon tax, I think, might totally change that investment equation. The value of that stock might drop, like, just catastrophically overnight.
I'll take a crack at that, unless you want to go, Todd.
Oh, no, please, be my guest.
Okay. Well, you've hit on a really crucial point, Steve, and Bill McKibben makes this point, too, that the value of the energy companies depends on their reserves. But if, in fact, the physics of our planet says that they can't possibly burn all those reserves without destroying the planet, there's a real problem there. At some point, the stock value of those companies is going to crash. Now, whether, as you just said, a carbon tax per se would make that happen, I don't know whether that's correct. There's a kind of a policy wonk argument about whether a cap or a tax, what's the difference and which is better. I think oil companies could live with a carbon tax, depending on how high it is. If it's not that high, I mean, look in Europe, they have gasoline taxes that are way higher than ours, and yet Europeans still drive.
Yeah.
I think you need a declining physical limit, which is to say caps. Let the price be set by the market, supply and demand, but let the thing the government should be concerned about is the physical limit, not the price.
Well, Todd, from your point of view, they're trying to make sure that there's sustainable development in these countries that have almost nothing but all of a sudden have a lot of oil. You wouldn't like to see the value of that oil decline. How would you see the future of these hydrocarbon producers in a world that had a cap on carbon?
Yeah. Look, the first thing is that we are now, you know, we think of the world as very, very well explored, and that we already know most of the great oil reserves. And I think that we're increasingly realizing that's probably not true. And in many parts of Africa, which I know best, we barely started to look for oil and natural gas, and we're actually finding it in lots of places. And the combination of $100 a barrel oil, all of the new technologies that are able to find oil, and then this series of discoveries that we've seen over the last 2 years, which is providing all kinds of new geological information, which will lead to further discoveries, I actually think that we're going to see world reserves go up significantly rather than down. And so the idea that it's just a couple or a handful of countries that are going to have this oil boom, I think, is probably wrong. The big difference, or the big unknown, is what could happen with the price, which, as we've seen with natural gas price has collapsed. And we've seen, a lot of countries maybe are going to see a 5, 10, or 15-year delay in production of their natural gas discoveries, and some of them probably will never be developed if the price doesn't recover.
Oh yeah, well, Alaska's North Slope is one of those where they're trying to figure out, well, we got to get gas up around $10 before we can build this pipeline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I think that the big issue on whether there's going to be a cap and trade or a carbon tax, how that's going to play into it, right now I think the problem is nobody knows. There's no way to price in the potential cost of a carbon tax in 2030, because nobody can tell you with any even remote certainty about whether that would happen or what it would look like or what the level would be. And that level of uncertainty in itself can hold back a lot of potential investment.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of this idea that Peter is propounding, that if you put a cap on it, the economic equation is going to kind of continue operating in the same way, it just can get shrunk by the cap?
Well, in theory, that makes sense, and I'm sorry if you talked about this before I got on the line, but you know, the U.S. certainly had a successful cap and trade with acid rain in the 1980s, and I think people look to that. The Europeans have been playing with a cap and trade currently, and they've really been struggling. This is carbon tax and carbon emissions is not a huge area of my research, but certainly my colleagues that work on this all seem to be coming around to the idea that a carbon tax is economically more efficient and more likely to get implemented.
Todd,
whether that's true or not, I just don't know.
Todd, I assume that there's going to be a lot of Alaska in your next book.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm really looking forward to it, and it's great to have you back on the show.
Great. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. Nice to meet you, Peter.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Peter Barnes, this was a real treat. I think you had some groundbreaking thinking here, and it's really a treat to be able to share that with my listeners up here in Alaska.
Well, it's a treat to be talking with you, Steve, and to be talking to people of Alaska as well. I think you got a great state there.
Well, it's very odd, you know. We had this conundrum with our gas line and how to pay for this gas line, and I was thinking, well, if we could just get the Ohio Valley power plants to get off of coal, we could sell our gas. Hey, guess what? Mm-hmm. They got off of coal anyway.
Right.
Peter Barnes, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
It's Talk of Alaska. Thanks so much to Dave Waldron at the controls and Josh Edge and all the other people that made it possible. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, with its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, ultrasound, and digital X-ray to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.